part of our salvation. So our longing for God, and I use this beautiful song verse, "My God, my soul longs for you." And there's this aching in the heart of a person who realizes that truly, as it says in the book of Ecclesiastes, everything that the world has to offer, ultimately, is vanity. It's all vain. There's nothing we can hold on to or grab that is going to satisfy the depth of the longing that we have in our heart to be fulfilled. Because that fulfillment can only take place with Christ and through Christ. It's the only way. An interesting thing that happened, though, is after the fall, something happened to man's heart. And the fathers of the church speak about different faculties of the soul. And one of the faculties of the soul that God gave to mankind is called epithymia. And epithymia is desire. So God gave to us within our entire being desire, longing. And it was given to us to desire and long for Him. After the fall, what happened is that longing and that desire, that faculty of the soul, was spread out around the world in the sense. And we started desiring things above God. So we started longing for things, and this is a real sort of testimony to how distorted that gift of longing has become for us. We can long for material things. We can long to have a certain car. We can long to have a certain TV screen. We can long and desire the latest version of an iPhone. We can long and desire to live in a certain part of the country or world or city. We can long and desire a relationship. And we pursue those things. And if we're really, really honest with ourselves, we'll begin to sense the sort of the anxiousness that surrounds that desire and the obsessiveness that surrounds that desire. If we were to be really honest, we would probably say, well, I can't get my mind off of the Samsung Galaxy 9. It's just like, because it's got this new feature, and my phone doesn't have that feature, and I just start thinking about it, and then the advertisement comes, and then someone else already has it, or whatever it may be, or you're driving down the road, you're saying, that's the next car that I want to get. Hey, that's the car I want to get. See that car? That's the car. That's the version. That's the model. And we obsess about these things, and we think about them, and we desire them. This is a misuse of anything. I liken this sometimes when I used to do a lot of work in the area of substance abuse in terms of just psychoeducation, teaching people the difference between drug use, drug misuse, and abuse, and then addiction. And we're all drug users. You know that, right? Who had coffee this morning? You're a drug user. What's the drug? Caffeine. It's a stimulant, right? And we build up a tolerance to that great drug, so we have to have two or three cups of coffee, and then eventually it just doesn't work at all. So, but we love the taste now, right? So we keep doing it. If we take Motrin or Tylenol or whatever it may be, we are drug users. When we misuse a drug, we use it for a purpose other than what it was really intended for. And so that's really what's happening with epithymia in us, that we're misusing this longing and desire that God gave us, which was to long and desire Him. We're now using it to long and desire for other things in the world. So this is sort of a reality of our fallen nature. So we have to really call into question and hold ourselves accountable when we notice, and that's the first step, when we notice that our longing and our desire is going outward to things of the world, because if it's going out there, it can't simultaneously go. And so we have to call into question, this longing that I have. Is this that important? Okay? Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about just briefly before we get into sort of more of the meat of this talk, I wanted to explain a little bit about attachment theory. You remember I mentioned that yesterday as one of the three things that really has influenced me in terms of my vocation and work as a therapist, but also just in terms of understanding people and relationships in general. Attachment theory was something that was developed by a gentleman by the name of John Bowlby, who lived in Great Britain. And it's interesting, I know a gentleman in Essex, England, who is a professor at the University of Essex. His name is Renos Papalopoulos. And Renos is a Jungian psychoanalyst type person, but he's very, very close to the monastery of St. John the Baptist, and he knew Elder Sofroni very, very, very well. Had many, many talks with him and so forth. But Renos was telling me that he also knew John Bowlby, because Renos did a lot of training in London, and there's an institute there where all the greatest psychologists and psychiatrists of the time sort of lived and worked and did their research and did their writing and collaboration and all that. And they were all sort of in that genre of psychoanalysis. And then he says, then there was a guy, John Bowlby, who was totally thinking outside of the box. And it was so far outside of the box that they gave him an office at the furthest corner of the building, where people really didn't have to interact with him. And he was studying really the relationships between a parent and a child. And what really, what was the impetus for his study is that he was seeing and receiving reports of children who were in orphanages and were having very little of any human interaction, human touch, or anything like that. And these children were not only a lot sicker than the average child, but some of them were actually dying in the crib. And this really not only concerned him, but it fascinated him. And so he wanted to find out why this is. So he began to do some research in the area. He gathered his data just based on the health of these infants, death rate, and he started sort of putting pieces of the puzzle together. And what he was discovering is that human touch and human interaction develops an infant's brain, social skills, and many, many other things within the child. So what Bowlby did is he had this one experiment called the strange situation or the stranger situation. And his research was this. He had a room, and he had a two-way mirror, and he would have a mother and a child. The child was maybe 3 or 4 or something like that. He would have the mother and a child in this room, but there was also a stranger just sitting in a chair. So there were some toys over here, the kids would play, the child would play. But when the mother brought the child into the room, and the stranger was just sitting there, just maybe reading a newspaper or something, he wanted to measure what the reaction would be of the child when the mother left the room. And so he was thinking, I want to see what kind of attachment stuff he's going on. And what's interesting is that he ended up not even measuring the response of the child when the parent left. What he ended up measuring was the response of the child when the parent returned to the room. And this was fascinating to him. And what he found is that, and there are 4 types of attachment. One is the secure attachment, and then there are 3 insecure attachment types. And this is really, really important because I have found in my integrative work that the way we attach to our primary caregiver obviously is reflected in the way that we attach to people as adults and even in our marriages, but how that sort of works itself out. And just theologically, too, we can look at how we attach ourselves to God. Okay? And what are those things that sort of could be blockages or barriers for us to having this, giving ourselves completely, faithfully, and trusting to God. So what he discovered was, when the mother came back into the room, if the child saw mom come in, the child got up, ran over and says, "Mommy, you're back," and hugged mommy, and says, "Come here, I want to show you something." And if she says, "No, just go ahead and play," he goes, "Okay, I'll go play, but I want to show you something." That was a secure attachment. Because the child knew that she could go and embrace mommy, mommy would embrace her. She also knew that she could leave mommy again and go play, and she felt secure. Okay? So that was the one thing he discovered. second one, now we get into the three insecure affective types. What happened was, when the mother came into the room, in this particular instance, the child ran over to mommy and clung to mommy, and clung to mommy, and clung to mommy. And mommy says, go ahead, honey, trying to peel the child off of her. But the child would go, and then she'd start crying. No, 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 no. And he saw that this child was insecure and was very, very anxious. So anxious that she wouldn't let go of mom out of fear. So he called this an insecure, anxious attachment. The second type of insecure attachment was mommy comes in the room and the child looks at mommy and then goes back to mommy. And what he discovered is that as he did questions, you know, and talked to the family and then the home, and some of that was home observation and talking to mom and so forth, is he found out that when a child over time realizes, as they are, even from the time of being in the crib, that when they're crying out and they have a need, there's no response by the parent. The child learns that mom's just not going to be there. So I'm not even going to try. I've learned that there's not going to be a response anymore. And he called this insecure avoidant attachment. Okay. The third and final one is when mom came into the room, the child kind of stood up and started to walk, but then walked away, and started to walk away, and then just kind of like started walking in circles and, you know, doing things like this. And there was a lot of confusion. And he labeled this insecure, disorganized attachment. And with this population, which was a smaller population, he found that there was abuse in the infant's life. And so the ambivalence is that that's my primary caregiver and I should be able to go, but that's also the hand that hits me and abuses me. But I want it, but I know it's going to hurt. But I know it's the right thing, but it's too painful. And so he called this that insecure, disorganized attachment. So what's really fascinating about this is two of John Bowlby's sort of understudies, Mary Ainsworth and Mary May, they then did what's called the adult attachment style. And there's a book called Attached. It's a very simple layman's sort of book on this understanding of attachment, adult attachment style. But what happens is that if you have a child who grew up with, let's say, an insecure, avoidant attachment, when they become an adult and they want to get into a relationship with someone, because that's natural, and there's sort of a longing to be in a relationship, and to have that sort of experience in life, they'll get into a relationship, and they can be very charming, things can be going very well, but as time moves on, and they see that this is getting serious, and their feelings are really starting to come out, and they're really starting to pour their heart into this person, they do something to sabotage the relationship, and then they leave. And this person over here is left standing thinking, what's going on? Why? I don't understand. Why did you leave? Why isn't this working? It's just not working. It's not going to work. And they'll come up with all these excuses as to why it's not working. That is a response that they learn as children that in their mind, and this is could be a very, or most of it is a very unconscious thing, is that I know that ultimately you're going to leave me and you're not going to be there for me. So before you do that, and I experience it again, which I experienced growing up in my life, I'm going to say goodbye. Or if you have an adult who gets into a relationship and things are going really well, but then they become really possessive, they want to know where you are and what you're doing and who you're with, and at all times they check on you and they get angry when you don't respond right away, and that is a person who, as a child, had an insecure, anxious attachment. They're very clingy, very needy, overbearing. So you can see how the experiences of primary caregiver and child early on develop these sort of attachment types or attachment styles later on in life. Most people are so unaware of it that it's out of their knowledge. They just don't know why they're even doing what they're doing. You know? But there's usually a very visceral response. It's fear or anxiousness. If a person talk through this a little bit, they would be able to at least describe sort of a felt sense of what's going on, even though they wouldn't be able to necessarily make the connection of why it's there or why it's sort of functioning in them, okay, unless they had someone who could kind of walk them through that. So as I studied this over the years, I began to realize a couple of things. One, because my mind is always sort of doing this integrative process, I realized as I was reflecting on my own life and my own attachment style that I grew up with, and I would say that I had an insecure avoidant attachment. Sometimes I also displayed an insecure anxious attachment as well, based on how I was parented. And I knew parents, they weren't abusive parents, but and they did the best they could, right? So, but I can examine, I can analyze, I can look at it now in terms of how that upbringing impacted me, and I've had to do a lot of work with sort of healing that and changing some of those things. And so I realized that unless I got a grip on that and began to really understand this and do some of the change, that it would impact me going forward, and it could be really problematic in my own marriage for years to come. The other thing I noticed is that when I would sit with spiritual children or hear confessions, I would hear these sort of statements come out of people that reflected insecure attachment experiences with God, like not trusting in God, or why would God do this? Or and these are all sort of attachment terms and expressions, and so. Though I didn't do this, I would ask some questions sometimes, but it wasn't a therapy session. But I would begin to, like when I worked with couples, I could really see if the husband was behaving this way to the wife, 9 times out of 10, I could guess that he came from a certain insecure attachment style. And so there was sort of a psychoeducation piece around that to help them understand themselves. But I really became interested in how our early attachment experiences affect the way we relate to God. It's fascinating, because it does. On the bright side of all this, because people will ask, oh my gosh, well, what do you do with people who have had insecure attachment styles growing up, whether it's anxious, avoidant, or chaotic, or disorganized? What do you do with that? And the beauty is, and I mentioned this yesterday, the beauty is that we have what's called earned attachment. And what that means is that there can be a person or other people in my life, a teacher, a coach, an uncle, a grandparent, a spiritual father, a therapist, it could be anyone or a combination of those, where my relationship with them and what I'm experiencing in that relationship is a very healthy, secure relationship style. There's nurturing, there's care, there's interest, there's dialogue, there's respect. All of these things that we would typically need growing up as a child, maybe didn't get in its fullness, or maybe sometimes even in partialness. But we begin to experience that, and these are the people we say things like, oh, I had the best third grade teacher ever. Now that's a body memory thing. That's an implicit statement. Because I may not be able to say, and the reason that I had the best third grade teacher ever was because, and come up with all this list of sort of explicit narrative sort of reasons as to why. I just know I had the best third grade teacher ever. It's an implicit, what we call a body or a somatic memory. It's not something that we can put any words around, but we just have that feeling. So it's a feeling memory or body memory. And the reason is because whatever that interaction was for that period of time, it was a very secure attachment style relationship. And we all have one. We could probably all pick at least one person who we would say has been really influential in my life or is really, really special to me. And those are those people that impact us and give us that experience of a secure attachment, what we call an earned attachment. And this actually changes our structure. Remember yesterday I said that it's through relationships that we are wounded, and the structure of our brain and the connections we make in our neural network system is sort of distorted. also through our relationships that we're healed, primarily with God and with other people as well. And God puts these people in our lives. And that's another indication of the love of the Father for us as children. Any questions about all of that? That was a little heavy on this side. we'll get into this side over here with the saints and stuff. Yes.
I mean, just a quick comment that I'm not sure I could tell. I mean, I don't know the degree of controls his study showed and whatnot, but just my gut response is that you can also see a secure attachment if somebody you know loves you walks into the room. You have the security. It's not necessarily avoidance. I mean, how would he differentiate that? The mother walking in the room, I'm so secure, I don't need to run to my mother to be hugged or whatever. You see what I'm saying? So I don't know how you can call that avoidance.
Well,
there must
this
be
study,
some elements of control to...
Yeah, his study was replicated hundreds of times cross-culturally.
Okay.
And the percentages were almost identical with all of them. In fact, Daniel Siegel out of UCLA, who came up coined the term interpersonal neurobiology, he studied attachment theory in its depth, and he saw that the predictability of knowing an adult's attachment style based on their childhood experience was, their predictability was something like 75%.
No, and I believe that, but I mean, it just seems hard. You would have to follow up with that parenting to see how they interact. I don't know. It just
a longitudinal study.
It seemed just very, to me, intuitive that if somebody I love walks in the room, I don't need to run to them because I'm so secure about who they are.
Yes.
It's just a little
yes, right. No, that's a good point.
Like it's
drawing
to a conclusion that maybe...
I think that, you know, when he was measuring is because the mother was gone, a small child's natural inclination is to reunite for just a little bit of time with mom. And I know this is too, because it's, you know, I studied these things for years, and I have 9 kids, so, like, I have my own lab at home. And one thing I noticed, it's really interesting. My wife is dying laughing right now. Over the years, I noticed that, like, when I come in the front door, how my little ones come up to greet me. And then they kind of go out back and they go to play. And so I'm like, okay, that's a secure attachment. So I must be doing something right. my older kids, I just get a shout from the top of the stairs. Hey, Baba, how are you doing? Good. You know, whatever. You know who always greets me at the door? My dog. I have a bull mastiff, Boxer Mix. He's 100 pounds. He's a dog. His name's Zeus, appropriately. But he sits up in the second floor of the girl's bedroom, and like he looks out the window. And by the time I get out of my car and I get to the door, he's right there. Right? And I grab him by his sloppy, drooly cheeks, and I say, "You're such a securely attached dog." He's talking about the most love of all the kids in the family. Yeah, earned attachment is a wonderful thing because it's really in part the undoing of an insecure attachment experience. So I can literally count on one hand 5 people who were just incredibly influential in my life. When I say that, I'm not saying that they gave me guidance or they did something extraordinary. What I'm saying is that my relationship with them was very heart-to-heart. They were just genuine, caring, interested, nurturing people. And I give thanks to God for those people in my life because I had an alcoholic mother and a very emotionally detached father growing up. So I know how that impacted my life. And those people were in my life even during those teenage years and throughout my young adult years and sort of, you know, in a span of time. And so having those opportunities to have those relationships and experiencing that is a very, very healing thing. And it gives me, and it would give any person to have those experiences, a sense of you know, they also did it. If you can Google this, but I forget the name of it. But there was a study done with children, and it must have been like a 1 year old or maybe a, I don't know, 1.5 year old. I forget the actual name of the experiment. And some of you may have seen this, but there's a little child sitting in a high chair, and mommy comes in and is like, "Hi, honey, how are you?" And oh, you know, just a lot of this nonverbal eye expressions and smiling and interaction and all this. Then the mother turns away just for a minute and comes back and is just, and the child's still going about, and then the mother's just catatonic, no expression, no words, no smile, no nothing. And they've done this repeatedly, this experiment. And the child begins to read those nonverbal cues and not only stops smiling and talking or cooing, but actually begins to cry. So this goes back to that the importance that Bowlby was seeing in these orphanages and in these hospitals where children are having zero connection with other human beings, zero nonverbal, zero touch, and all these sort of things. But if you remember, it wasn't long ago that the expert, Dr. Spock, was saying that when your child cries, let them cry, it out. Today, attachment theory would say, no, that's not the right way to do it. Because what you're doing is, this child has a need and is asking for intervention and connection. And so Dr. Spock would say, well, you just need to look crying out, it'll be fine. But what we're finding is that creates a very insecure attachment, avoidant attachment style. Now, I know, I've been through this 9 times. I know what it's like to have a crying child in the middle of the night. And it's exhausted and it's hard. However, connecting with that child and soothing them is always a better option. I see parents all the time, I mean, whether it's at, you know, Walmart or Target or wherever, restaurant or out and about, and it's interesting how parents will talk to like a 1 or 2 year old as if they're an adult. Mm-hmm. And they have this expectation that they just have to behave. And when a child is crying, what they need at that moment is comfort and consolation. Because their whole sympathetic nervous system is just going crazy. And it's the adult's responsibility as the external hard, emotional hard drive to regulate, because the child doesn't have the skill set to regulate that within themselves. And comfort and touch and a soothing voice will bring that sympathetic nervous system down and regulate them emotionally. Then you can have some talk if you want to. So we have this adage that we want to connect and then correct. We want to calm them, and then we can have a discussion. How many times have we had a discussion with a spouse or a child, and we're both really heated? Really doesn't go anywhere, right? So when we can approach one another in a calm state, in a respectful and a loving way, then we can make progress. So that earned attachment is really, really important. And not only have I experienced it as a person, as a teenager, on through my adult years with different people, but as a therapist, I always knew that I was in the position of being an earned attachment catalyst for the people I was seeing in therapy. And most of the time, it was done through my voice, and not words, but my tone. And I would always try to speak to people and respond to them in a very soft tone. That in itself can be transformative. People will say things like, "I really, really want to thank you, and I enjoy the time. You're very gentle." They're not saying, you know, when you said this, it made sense, when you told me you did that, it worked, and then when you gave me this advice, it's like the fact that you were just there. And there's a sort of this gentleness, calmness about you, which we're going to talk about in our little reflection later. It was really, really soothing. And so this is that felt sense experience that we get from people that really, really helps us. And so when people are frantic or there's an accident or your child or whatever, it's always best to be a calm presence with that person. That will do more than words. So we can be the instrument of earned attachment for they go through these developmental stages where things are made appropriate, and there is that time where they, the world, they are the center of their universe, it's infancy, you know. Yeah, if it continues, then that could be a little problematic. I think that, you know, whether it's in a relationship with our children or even in our marriages, we need to balance a healthiness of togetherness versus separateness. Children who have a secure attachment style feel very free to explore and to be on their own. And you'll see this in children. They play by themselves a lot better. Although there is, you can notice that I was talking to a woman, I made a mistake telling this woman on the plane on the way down here that I was a favorite instead of Greece. But she asked and I couldn't lie. So the 2 hours went like that for her.
His love for
So a tragedy occurs, we become angry. How can he do this? How can God allow this to happen? Okay, so then we start attaching meaning to the tragedy and attach meaning to God's love. We can begin to question now his love, right? So this can derail along, because if I'm attaching the meaning that God did this, why would I want to be embraced by God? That's the one who just, I'm making sense of it. He's the one who caused the tragedy, so I can't draw near to him. Okay, what else? What else can derail our longing for God?
Doubt.
Good.
Mental illness.
What's that?
Mental illness.
Mental illness. You mean the person has mental illness?
Yeah.
Okay.
Distractions.
Distractions. Grapes, and he says his thoughts weren't really on anything, And he was flooded by the grace of God. Tears started coming down his eyes. He just felt this peace and this grace and this joy. It was overwhelming, he says. And he goes, and I realized that the grace and love and mercy of God comes when it wants to come, at a time least expected by us. And when that happens, we need to be still and really sit with it. Stop everything if you can. Pull over. Pick whatever you need to do. Because this is that thing that the soul longs for the most. So one of the answers that I want to give you to how we increase our love and longing for God, and the way that we can really also attract the grace of God, is summed up in one word, a word that you find in St. Paisus' writing, and it's called philotimo. How many of you have heard of the word philotimo? Oh, good. So this is good. I first came across this word in St. Paisus' writing several years ago. In fact, you will find this word, philotimo, in almost all of the literature that's being published and translated by St. Paisus today. And having read really much of what he has already written, I began to really take notice of like, the various ways that he was using this term. As a marriage therapist, I began to think of this word and its use within the context of marriage, as well as in all other relationships that we have in life, whether it's friends, or co-workers, or church members, etc. But I realized how important both the understanding and the practices of this word. So I want you to really listen to this, because this is huge. This is huge. So let's take a look at this word. In the book, With Pain and Love for Contemporary Man, by St. Paisus, this is one of the ways he describes philotimo. It's a little bit longer of a definition. It's not too long, but just listen to this. The reverent distillation of goodness, the love shown by humble people for which every trace of self has been filtered out. Their hearts are full of gratitude towards God and their fellow man, and out of spiritual sensitivity and a sense of honor, they try to repay the slightest good which others do for them. So let me read that again. And if you want to write this down, I'll just leave this for you during lunchtime, and you can copy it if you want. Or take a picture of it, right? The reverent distillation of goodness, the love shown by humble people for which every trace of self has been filtered out. Their hearts are full of gratitude towards God and their fellow men. And out of spiritual sensitivity and a sense of honor, they try to repay the slightest good which others do for them. So in a word or two, philotimo is this grateful indebtedness. It is being humble-minded. And one of the best definitions I read was, it's holding the other person always in your heart. Holding the other person. It's also been defined as one who out of deep gratitude loves and lives, striving to think, say, and do that which is honorable, and one who aims eagerly at acting in an honorable and virtuous way in all situations and circumstances. It also refers to the inner disposition one has of responsive gratefulness, a virtuous demeanor that is expressed in thoughts, words, and deeds, a responsive gratefulness. It is the deep-seated awareness in the heart that motivates the good that a person does for others. It is the humble, dignified, and respectful way people interact with one another, family members, friends, fellow parishioners, and in general with all people. And you specifically, in the spiritual sense, philotimo expresses the intense and constant feeling of deep appreciation and heartfelt gratitude for God's gifts to such a degree that the soul feels the inner need to freely and thankfully respond. It is the feeling of not being able to give back enough. I want to share with you just a quick example of this. In 1989, when I was on Holy Mountain, I was leading one monastery, as were other pilgrims. I was a layperson, a young man, a seminarian. England, a young monk from England, a long red beard, red hair, and he's probably in his maybe late 20s, I would guess, early 30s, and he was visiting. And when he left the monastery, one of the monks gave him this really beautiful, warm loaf of bread, fresh out of the oven, for his journey. And so we all were coming down the mountain on that side, and we got into the boat. It was a smaller boat. And as the boat shoved off and we started traveling along the side of the peninsula there, he took the bread and he began to break it and hand a piece to every person that was on the boat. And then he kept a very small piece for himself. After he did his cross, he consumed it. To me, that's belonging. That's grateful indebtedness. That is a grateful responsiveness. He was so grateful that he was gifted with this warm loaf of bread that he was compelled out of his heart to give back and share it with people. That's beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful term. And I think that if we can teach our children, if we can learn this first, but if we can teach, especially our children or grandchildren or godchildren, if we can teach them through our actions what this word means, and how to apply it, we're going to raise up saints. Because our kids will never take anything for granted. They will see everything they receive as a gift, and they will want to respond by giving out to others, out of people. So you'll see this word a lot. It can mean gratitude for anything from a small gift or act of kindness someone has shown you to appreciation even for one's parents or heritage. Reverent distillation of goodness means the act of purifying and extracting what is essential on behalf of and for others. Filtering out any trace of self, part of that definition, what we would call theologically kenosis, right? Or self-emptying of one's will so that one can become entirely receptive to the will of God. Another part of the definition, a heart that is full of gratitude because it recognizes all the blessings that one has received in life and continues to receive. This is something I think we have to get much, much better at. As we know that our minds just travel 1,000 miles an hour and we have to make all these thoughts throughout the day, when we begin the day or when we close the day or both times or at some point in the day, we should always make a part of our prayer rule to give thanks for what God has blessed us with. And be specific. Be specific. Find the things that you can enumerate. And this can happen even if you're driving in your car. Pause in your thoughts and just give thanks to God for your life, your health, the car you're driving, your family, if you're going to work, that you have a job. But from your heart, give great, great thanks and show that gratitude to God. Thanksgiving is a huge part of developing a spirit of belonging home. It really is a huge part of developing the grace of God within us. It's a conscious and unending awareness that one's life, every breath, is being sustained each second of the day by the mercy and grace of God. Holding the other in the heart, I think of the passage in Scripture that he who wishes to be first must be last. And I also think of the passage by St. Cyril, who says, my brother is my life. My brother is my life. You could say, my family is my life. When he says, my brother is my life, he's saying all of humanity, right? We can start small over. Nothing is taken for granted with the spirit of belonging. There's no sense of entitlement, which is something our kids, a lot of kids I see, are growing up with, this sense of entitlement. Even in marriages, what have you done for me lately? You know? This sense. But in Philodemon, there is no sense of entitlement that I deserve something or that I'm owed something. Out of this deep awareness of one's nothingness, coupled with the fact that one's very life is a gift, the person tends to repay the slightest good that is done for them. St. Paisius reminds us that we are not to practice good acts for our own benefit, ever. That is, in order to be rewarded or to avoid hell or gain paradise, but rather because we want to imitate Christ. This is our motive. This way, the good we do, he says, has dignity. Otherwise, it originates from the cheap attitude. attitude of give and take. When we begin to see life through a spirit of philotimo, we will engage the world in an entirely different way. We will engage our relationships in an entirely different way. If I think really good thought to all the things that my wife does on a daily basis and develop that great sense of gratitude, I will engage her differently. This is what we can do to change the way we function. Most of the time people say, well, if she would just do this and this, or if he would just stop, you know, doing these things, or if my kids would just, or if the priest would just, or if the church would just, we externalize and we give control to that which is out there, and then we become sour and bitter. This is called external locus of control. We can do nothing about it. We just wish for it, we complain about it. Internal locus of control is shifting the way that I see things and the way I think, and it'll change the way I function. One adage I learned in family systems theory is that changing the way you see people gives you the best opportunity to change the way you function in that relationship. So I grew up with a father who, as I said, was very emotionally absent, and it was rough at the time, especially my teenage years, and I had a really, really difficult relationship with him. It wasn't physically combative, but it was emotionally combative, verbally combative, and it was just a horrible, horrible feeling to have that relationship anymore. When I was in seminary, I came home one year and I was sitting with my grandmother, his mom, my Sophia, and in her broken English and her Greek, and we sat down and we started talking, and I started asking her questions. I said, "What was Dad like as a child? What was it like growing up for him with his siblings and Papu? What was life after childhood like?" And she started sharing all this stuff with me about that, about his life as a child, how he related with his father, how he was the last of four children, which I knew, but his father really didn't connect with him at all, how he went off to World War II, became a medic, saw trauma after trauma on the battlefield, how he came back, all these things. And she started informing me, and I started gaining this understanding of my father, and it totally shifted the way I saw my father. I never saw him as a son anymore. I saw him as a person who was really, really wounded and had a lot of trauma and a lot of sadness and brokenness in his life. And as I began to see him that way, I began to realize that this man, too, is one of the walking wounded. And the feeling of anger and the angst I had with him just disappeared. My dad never changed, but my relationship changed because I saw him before. This is the beauty of internal locus of control, that we can choose to change the way we see people and situations and all these, and change them the way we feel and the way we function. This is the good news beside the scripture good news. Because this will bring us a lot of peace when we realize this and begin to practice this. Yes, you have to come.
Thank you. This marvelous word that you told us, could you spell it for us?
Yeah, P-H-I-L-O-T-I-M-O. It's a compound word. Fili, which is love, fili, and timio, which is honor. So the word is like an honor of love. It's really beautiful. Yeah. So let me go back to this one statement. I just have a couple more little things here. So when we begin to see life through a spirit of philotimo, through gratefulness and gratitude, we will engage the world and people differently. We will demand less, and we will give more, because our sense of indebtedness has been increased in us. Out of deep gratitude, we will see our spouse as a gift from God. We will see our children. We will see many things as gifts from God. Our longing for God is natural to us because we have been created in His image. Of course, we want to have continuous communion with God, but when we get distracted, we become sidetracked in life. Our longing and our desires are diverted elsewhere because we are not calling on the Lord daily and do not give attention to the ways in which we have been so blessed. This is why it's so important. that stress cannot coexist with a relaxed body. It's impossible. And in the same way, when we have a spirit of grateful indebtedness in philokimo, we cannot also have